Netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney, you're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Hi, welcome to this week's FX Podcast. I'm Mike Seymour. You know, it's hard to think of the industry back in the days of pre-digital, to think of a company, for example, like ILM, back when, you know, it really was quite inept at doing digital stuff in comparison to the powerhouse that it is today, able to produce things like Transformers and Pirates of the Caribbean and Star Trek. But somebody that spanned that entire period from ILM, and in fact helped ILM do the transition into digital, to forming Digital Domain and doing amazing things today is Scott Ross. Scott, as many of you know, was one of the co-founders of Digital Domain. And Jeff Huser this week sits down with Scott, not only to talk about the old days and some of the really phenomenally interesting anecdotes from days gone by, but also to look at the state of the industry today. Because it's Scott's opinion on where the industry is at and where it's moving that I find to be some of the most interesting aspects of this really exceptional interview. Let's cross to that now.
Well, thanks, Scott, for joining us.
You're welcome, Jeff.
So you're in a unique position. When we talk about history of visual effects, we often think the optical printer days and go back to the very beginnings. But the transition to digital happened, obviously, in our lifetime, and you were right in the middle of it.
I was, yeah. It was at Industrial Light & Magic. When I first got to Industrial Light & Magic, I was its general manager. And, you know, because I came out of the video world, and we knew each other back then, you know, I was very comfortable with and very familiar with transputer-based computers. And when I got to Industrial Light & Magic, this is probably going to be, I'll say, 1987, 88. What was happening at ILM was they were in the middle of working on a movie called Who Framed Roger Rabbit, and everything was done on optical printers. And I hadn't been around film, you know, in terms of post-production film, since college, since 1972, 73. So I had forgotten all my film post chops. And here they were, you know, doing wedges and doing lineup sheets and doing, you know, 40 frame composites and all on optical printers. And so it was just shocking to me. And when I got there, it was also at a point in time where capital equipment was really cut way down low. I had come in just after Richard Edlund had built the quad printer, and a lot of money was spent on capital equipment at Industrial Light & Magic from about 1980 to about 1985. And George had a pretty bad experience, I guess, with Pixar in terms of the cost of building that hardware. And so as a result of that, the company really didn't spend any money on capital equipment. And, you know, where you and I came from, that was our lifeblood, you know, in video post-production. Every year there was something new and you had to buy it, whether it was a new Rank Centella or a new Harry. And so when I got there, it was just shocking to me that they weren't doing anything in terms of capital equipment, and they were doing nothing in terms of computer or transputer-based processing, except for the Pixar Cube, right, as a result of Lucasfilm owning Pixar. And I just didn't quite understand, besides the resolution issues, why things couldn't be done. So when I got there, there was an optical scanner that they had built with Pixar. It was a bread box thing. It farted every couple of seconds, you know. But there was a device that could take film into a digital format. So there was a scanner. And then, having worked with Quantel a bunch, I knew that there was a user interface that would allow us to be able to work in an environment that we could composite and create images using Quantel's Harry and Paintbox interface. And at that time, they were starting to really make a lot of noise about a high-def Paintbox as well and a high-def Harry.
Right. They had done, like, I think, the Printbox.
That's right.
Which was just for stills, but it was super high-res Paintbox.
Right. And then, you know, there was, I guess it was Oxbury, had a output device that would take digital information and then put it back out onto film. So it seemed like there was the possibility of a system that could be an all-digital system. And naively, what I did was I went to each one of those companies, Kodak, Oxbury, Quantel, and then I needed a transputer or a computer environment that allowed us to be able to do imagery at very high resolutions very, very quickly. And there was a lot of talk about this new company called Silicon Graphics. So as a result, in my naivete, I tried to pull all of these companies together. And, you know, we flew to England and Newbury, I guess it was, where Quantel was, and Rochester. And as a result of these meetings, they all walked away saying, wow, this is great, but we're going to do the whole thing. Each one of them. So Quantel went down its path with an input device and an output device and a user interface. Kodak wound up starting their software company. I forget what it was called.
Cineon,
right? And okay. they wound up hiring a bunch of people in Australia, I guess, and tried to put some software together. And as a result, things fell apart. And at ILM, we chose a different path. And the path was the only path that it could work for us was, in the beginning, it was Macintoshes. And then we transitioned to SGIs. And we were using the Oxberries to shoot back out onto film. And Kodak had built a trilinear array device that would allow us to take film and transition it into a digital medium. And that's what we used. And it was a cultural upheaval. It was difficult. Not only difficult from a technology point of view, like, for example, on Indiana Jones and The Last Crusade, we were using prototype Photoshop and two Macintoshes, one for odd frames, one for even frames. And we'd hand off. So you'd do frame one, and then it would process, and you'd do frame two, and then it would process, etc. But the technical issues were nowhere near as difficult as the cultural issues. And the cultural issues became very, very difficult. And there were a lot of people who just didn't get it and swore that it would never happen. There were a lot of people who got it or who came from that world and swore that the old world was dead and they needed to learn nothing from it. And that took us about 9 months to a year to iron out. And then here we are, you know, and then the train had left the station and toot toot, you know.
It's fascinating to think that history is not that long ago, really. I mean,
late 1980s.
Right.
Yeah.
So it's not that long ago.
20 years ago.
And you don't think about you kind of remember the technical stuff, but the political stuff is not nearly as remembered, I'm sure.
I remember, here's a quick story. At ILM, we had some of the greatest matte painters of all time. These guys painted on glass, you know, Michael Pengrazio, you know, just killer matte painters, Craig Barron. And a bunch of the digital guys were now, as Photoshop was really coming into its own, and John Knoll was at the company, right, and one of the founders of Photoshop. And it seemed obvious that we were going to transfer from glass to digital. And I decided that what I needed to do is I needed to take the digital guys and sit them down with the old school masters, right? And we set that up. And as a result of that, about 2 hours into the meeting, I ran into one of the digital guys in the hallway, and I said, hey, Stefan, how's it going? And he said, we have enough of that already. We understand everything. We could stop it. We just move on. We don't need... And I thought to myself, now these guys have been painting on glass for like 20, 25 years. And 50 years before that, their fathers, some of them, were painting on glass. And that the guys in the digital world were prepared to just say, well, you know, we got what they have and we're done. We're ready to move on. But it was the manipulation of the egos and the massaging of their hard feelings that allowed it to grow. And it was difficult. All of the visual effects supervisors that I'd ever worked with up until Apollo 13 were all old school visual effects supervisors. You know, Dennis Muren and Kenny Ralston and Scott Farrar and, you know, John Bruno, and they were all old world visual effects supervisors, meaning they worked in the optical model. And so in managing an overall project, you'd look at the number of shots, and then you'd look at the timeline that you had to be able to complete it. And based upon history and gut, you could sort of feel that you were going to get there. Because that's always one of the big issues. Are we going to make it, right?
Working to the deadline.
And so on Apollo 13 was the first time I worked with a visual effects supervisor who didn't come out of the optical process. And it was Rob Legato, and he came out of Star Trek television series. So it was interesting. I came out of television, and then I had worked at ILM for a number of years and then started Digital Domain, and I had forgotten what the television environment was like. And so everything was optical, and we're looking at, you know, as a show is moving forward, well, how many shots do we have? How many CBBs do we have? How many finals do we have? And we're charting it and watching it. And I remember on Interview with the Vampire, I don't remember the number of shots, But we were probably 3 weeks away from delivery, and we had like five finals. And I thought it was over. I mean, I didn't get it, right? And then as we got to the delivery date, everything finaled. Because what had happened was, in the old paradigm, you needed to do pre-comps, and then once you got your pre-comps done, then you got your comps, then you got your finals, and it was done, and you moved it aside. But in the digital environment, the option to change was always there. So you never had a final until the day you needed a final, which is the day of delivery. And that was a brave new world. The light switch went off in my head that day, and I went, oh my God, how do we now monitor shows? We can't look at it in the old way. And there's this whole new way of dealing with it. And so what happens is you have to look at the work and say, well, even if it's not a final, because it's not been called a final, could it be a final, right? And that's how you start looking at it. You start rating your shots as to, well, is it complete or not? I know we could work on it for another 2 weeks, but if I had to final it today, is it good enough to be a final? And that was a whole different way of working, and it was really, really shocking to us, to me, you know? And that's the way everybody works now.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Sure. I mean, a lot of shows. I mean, and it's also a matter of style, too. A lot of directors don't like the final things.
That's right. Yeah, they want to keep their options open.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, why wouldn't you?
Absolutely.
But economically, that has to work for everybody, too, though.
Well,
keeping the options open costs money at some point.
Well, you know, the worst thing that's going to kill you on a show is having too much time with too little time, right? Too little time is bad. Too much time is terrible. I want to know when the final date is, when I have to go to air. And then I start to say, okay, now I'm sort of comfortable because I got 6 months to complete the work. Now I can budget it because I know how big the beast could possibly be. You know, but if it's, well, you know, listen, give us a lower price because we don't have a date. We could just let it go and you could fit it in. Not at all.
So let's go back all the way to your history. I mean, you were born in New York, I take it?
I was born in New York, yeah, in the Bronx, mm-hmm. 1951. As I like to say, a poor young white boy. I was born as a poor young white boy. And I lived in the Bronx, in the South Bronx, until the mid-50s, and then moved to Queens. And was born and raised in Queens, went to high school there, and then went to college at Hofstra University in Hempstead, Long Island, and got an undergraduate degree in film. But really, I got an undergraduate degree in staying out of Vietnam. That's really what my major was. And it worked out pretty well. I didn't go. And I'm here today to talk about it. And then I got really swept up in music, was the concert chairman at my school. And, you know, music was, as you know, we've talked about it a bunch, you know, it was really the voice of our generation and really was, for me, what made the world go round. And I got really deep into music. I became a player. I toured with bands as their sound engineers. And I did that all the way up until the mid-1970s. And then I just got fed up with it. And I kept having recurring dreams that I would wake up at 40 in a shiny black suit playing Havana Gila, you know, and I decided that wasn't for me. So then I moved from that into film and television, and then I wound up moving to San Francisco and headed up a company called One Pass, which was the seminal post-production company in the Bay Area. Did that for a number of years and then was headhunted by Lucasfilm and came over in the mid-80s and stayed there until the early 90s. And then at the age of 41, decided I needed to become an entrepreneur and started Digital Domain.
But now, obviously, Digital Domain has moved on to other owners.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I'm very excited about it. I mean, it was, I had, on an emotional level, really run out of steam at Digital Domain probably the last 2 to 3 years. I was, you know, I had done, if you consider One Pass, it was from the, you know, the late 70s all the way up until the early 2000s, 2003, 2004. So, you know, it was 30 years of visual effects and post-production, and I just ran out of steam. I got tired of the clients. I got tired of the artists. I was tired, and it was time. And as I look back at it now from a financial point of view, an economic point of view, it was probably the best time to sell. You know, it wasn't planned in my head that this is the right time to sell, But sometimes, you know, spirit looks out for you, and it was the right time to sell.
Right. Well, the business climate certainly has evolved. I mean, from those days with Roger Rabbit and transitioning to digital, I'm sure at that time, you know, it was just all magic to everybody. And, you know, to now, it's commodity.
Well, yeah, it is. To an extent, it's a commodity. It's become much more of a commodity. But the really, really spectacular work that's being done today is as difficult and as non-commoditized as it was back in the 80s and in the 70s. There are very few people, companies that can do the work of the quality of, you know, the big five houses. And if you look at it, it's really rare over the past 25 or 30 years when one of the big five houses, Weta, Sony, ILM, Rhythm and News Digital Domain, is not the winner of the Best Visual Effects Academy Award. So, you know, the proof is in the pudding.
I know that one of the things, I found that interview from 98 from Millimeter with you, and you had a quote about the role of the visual effects companies having to change.
Right.
To becoming more involved with content and developing films. Can we talk a little bit about that? I mean, I don't think that's necessarily happened.
It hasn't. I mean, well, a couple of them have, which is sort of interesting, and they've been done fabulously well, and there have been people that have really changed the world of movies and made a lot of people very, very wealthy as a result of that, and we know who they are, but we'll come back to it. The problem with the visual effects industry is that the visual effects industry is not a business. So, and I mean that by it's not a business in the sense that it can't be run as a business with return on equity and return on investment. If you're a mom-and-pop company and there's 10 guys or gals that work for you and you're happy with your salary and you manage it wisely and you have the skill sets to understand capital depreciation, et cetera, it could be a lovely living for a relatively long period of time. It's a young person's game. You know, at some point when you're 45, you're saying, why am I doing, you know, 18-hour days for 15-day stretches? But you can make a living. But as a business, meaning you have investors, they give you money, you return on investment and on equity, it just doesn't exist because the margins aren't there. And the cost of the work is so extraordinarily high. And I think the industry has not really become aware of how important it really is to the overall success of the movie industry. I mean, I think they talk it, but they don't walk the walk and talk the talk. And if they were aware of that, I think the economic model for how visual effects companies get paid and visual effects supervisors get paid would radically change.
I know the VES has talked about that. Jeff Okun's talked quite a bit about that. You know, we kind of tend to be our own worst enemy, that we're like, oh, that's easy, we can do that, or, you know, undersell ourselves.
Well, I think a lot of it comes from, you know, especially if you have a relatively large organization. I build the analogy of it's like owning a fleet of planes. You know, so if you're an airline and you have a fleet of planes and you have to maintain them and you have flight attendants and pilots and whatnot, and they're sitting on the ground, the only variable is gasoline. But you're losing so much more money having your plane sit on the ground than you are losing money per seat. So if you have to charge $100 a seat to break even, it's less devastating to charge $80 a seat than to have your plane sit on the ground. So what happens with these large companies, and even some of the smaller companies, is they have such an incredible investment and such high overhead in terms of staff and software and et cetera, that they'd rather lose money on the job than not take the job. And so what that does is it creates a buyer's market. So every buyer goes to another company and says, I can get this for $10. Can you do it for $9? And the guy at the other company says, okay, I'll do it at $9. And then they go and say, well, what about $8? And what happens is they eat themselves. And the funny thing about it is, if you go back to Harvard Business School sensibilities, the stuff that the high-end companies do, the high-quality work, really drives the market. And it's not a commodity, right? But it's priced like a commodity, and that's the real sort of downfall of the industry.
Well, it's interesting. I always look at ILM today and Pixar today as two companies in terms of the business that the big advantage they both share is they always have a constant flow. I mean, the quality of
the Well, ILM doesn't.
Well, but more so than a lot of the smaller companies.
Sony Pictures Imageworks had a constant flow. But the getting back to the content issue, there's a real key answer right there. So you have two, over the last 20 years, two of the leading companies in the world, Pixar and ILM. And ILM, Pixar was owned by Lucasfilm. So Pixar winds up becoming a content company and is now worth billions and billions of dollars, and in many ways could say really gobbled up Disney, right?
Yeah.
So Pixar has become Disney, not Disney has become Pixar. No, Disney has become Pixar, is what I'm saying. I mean, you know, you look at the people that were at Pixar, and now they're the key people at Disney and on the board. You look at ILM, and ILM's barely making any money, you know, if they're making any money at all. So they're caught in the services game, and Pixar's caught in the content game. And as Mae West said, you know, I've been rich and I've been poor. I'd much rather be in the content game.
Why hasn't that happened?
Well, I think a couple of things. Several of the well, let's look at the three major content companies in computer graphics, visual effects area. And that would be Pixar, which used to be owned by Lucasfilm, and then became a hardware company, then became a software company, and then became a small production company, right? And in a lot of ways, what Pixar was is exactly in many ways what Digital Domain or Sony Pictures Imageworks or Weta was, right? Only a lot smaller. And then look at PDI. So PDI becomes DreamWorks Animation, and they're fabulously successful, all right? So they make the transition from being in the services business to being in the content business, and most importantly, having a partner that's in the distribution business.
Distribution's so key.
So if you could make that transition, then things start to happen. Now, obviously, there's the issue of who's the talent, right? And everybody goes, well, you know, John Lasseter is so amazing, and he is, but we've worked with people in the industry, and there are several John Lasseters out there, and I think any one of those companies, if they were managed correctly and moved in that direction, could become a content company. They lack a couple of things. One is the capital to do so, and then secondly is the distribution partner to make it really work.
I mean, I know you tried at Digital Domain for a long time.
Yeah.
To get into that. That was.
Oh, let me add something else, Jeff. You know, because one of the other issues, if you look, and let's just go to the big five again. You know, if you look at Weta, Weta has an owner that's in the content business. And if you look at Sony Pictures Imageworks, they have an owner that's in the content business. And then you look at Lucasfilm, they have a ILM, an owner that's in the content business. Now, the other two companies, Rhythm and Use and Digital Domain, do not have owners in the content business, or at least in Digital Domain's case, an owner who might have been in the content business but has no interest in allowing Digital Domain to be in the content business, right? Because, you know, at the end of the day, Jim Cameron owned a percentage of Digital Domain. He owned all of Lightstorm Entertainment. So where would he rather put his content? In something he owned totally or something that he owned just fractionally?
You know, there's all this, there's the every 10-year, you know, Blair Witch Project and now this Paranormal Activity. You know, you have to wonder if there's not, you know, at some point somebody will come up with a visual effects, you know, a more visual effects centric breakout small film.
District 9, you know, District 9, a $30 million movie. And I don't know what the numbers are totally, but it was very, very successful. And it was stunning. You know, what a great film. So there are the opportunities are there. Part of it is managing it. Another issue, too, is finding the right talent. So just because you're a visual effects supervisor doesn't mean you're a content creator. In fact, if we look at the history again of visual effects supervisors, very few, though many have tried, very few have become, you know, successful directors.
You know, at the recent VES had a summit recently, and there was a lot of illusion. They had some people from the studios there.
Uh-huh.
And it wasn't tense per se. Well, there were some points where it was tense per se. But that relationship between the studios and visual effects companies seems to be stressful.
Well, I think there's lots of reasons why it's stressful. You know, I subscribe to the concept of that, you know, if you got a guy who's always crying the boy who cried wolf, then he looks at everybody else as they cry wolf as well. So, interestingly enough, when you work at the studios and when you get profit participations as a creative person with a studio project, the studios have, and it was called Buchwaldian economics for a long time, you know, the Art Buchwald case against Paramount. The studios have notoriously been the kinds of people that inflate overhead and inflate all kinds of things and inflate distribution fees to be able to pull as much money as they possibly could off the table before any of the distribution, you know, before any of the participation fees are paid, you know, back-end participation fees. So if that's the kind of cat you are, that's the environment that you grow up in, that's the way you look at the world, that's your language, then when you're looking at other bids from other companies, and in their bid they have a 25% markup fee, which really includes legal and management and rent and all of that stuff. It's legitimate. You know, the studio starts to say, well, what hanky-panky are you playing here? You know, because we play hanky-panky all the time, right? Sure. So I'm assuming you're playing hanky-panky. Now, fortunately or unfortunately, we don't play hanky-panky. It really is 25% markup because it has to cover our expenses. So they walk in oftentimes with the concept that this stuff costs too much. And oftentimes, studio executives' jobs are to be able to go to their bosses and say, this stuff costs too much, and I'll figure out a way how to do it less expensively. So there's this unholy alliance between studios and visual effects companies, where visual effects companies are always feeling like they're going to be screwed, and vice versa. You know, studios think that they're going to be screwed, because generally they don't understand it either. So that, you know, so that sets up a situation that's very, very difficult. And what studios have done over the years, particularly with all of the tax incentives that are happening and governments that are giving discounts, and they've been able to drive the price of visual effects down, 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 down. And in doing so, you're winding up putting unbelievable stress and duress on visual effects companies. And as a result of that, I think we've seen a lot of visual effects companies go out of business, and I think we're just at the tip of the iceberg, and I think we'll see a lot of the bigger visual effects companies go out of business in the next couple of years. The irony of it all is that today, as opposed to movie stars, right, visual effects is what sells tickets,
sure,
right? So nobody's going to see Transformers 2 because of Shia LaBeouf. Right? They're going to see it for the robots. And nobody went to go see The Day After Tomorrow because of whoever the actor was in that. They went to see New York get devastated by a flood. That's what puts butts in the seats. So now the studios know that, right? And they're upping the ante incredibly. You know, we're going to see movies coming out pretty soon that are just going to be unbelievable in terms of visual effects, Avatar in 2012 and the like. And the only way they're able to get that high-end work and the quantity of work is to go to the Big Five. But the Big Five are under such weighty duress because of the way they've been paid over the last 5 years, they're on the brink of going out of business. And so it will be really interesting to see what the studios do faced with this issue. I need high-quality visual effects, and I needed a lot of it. Mm-hmm. Now what do I do?
Yeah, I mean, if one of the five goes,
wow,
it's already a big chunk.
Yeah, a big chunk. And as we said, you know, we look at the companies or the people that won Best Visual Effects Awards for the Academy over the last, I think, 30 years, probably 95% of it is one of the big five. Always is.
Right.
Even when a guy who works at a big five and leaves a big five after having won an Academy Award, he never wins one again. Never.
Well, big companies, small companies, both seem to be under stress. I mean, small companies, you know, are even small companies now are starting to set up outposts in states with tax incentives and
right.
other countries just because they're forced to. They have to. They have
right.
those relationships. You know, what does someone there's no answer to this question, I know, but what does someone do? What would be a good perspective from the artist standpoint for survival?
Well, I think from the artist standpoint, it's the future is rosy, actually. I think from the company owners, facilities owners standpoint, the view is very bleak. But, you know, I remember in the early days, we would do a movie. I guess it was Terminator 2. I think it had 54 visual effects shots in it. You know, today you do a Sandra Bullock, Matthew McConaughey romance, you know, chick flick, and it's got 150 shots in it.
Or 600.
That's
yeah,
right.
Absolutely.
So the demand for the work has really gone up. Now, the community has gotten much larger as well. It's become a global community, and it will continue to do so. But I think what's going to happen is we're going to go into a hub-and-spoke model. And the hub's going to be core creative people and production people in Los Angeles, London, New York, Australia, wherever. And then the work will be outsourced to people that do the work the best at the lowest price, and that could be artists in Mumbai, India, artists in Paducah, Kentucky. And you could, you know, now when we used to work, it was, you know, you had to live in L.A., and you come from Chicago and I come from the Bay Area, and I know it was a tough move for most of us that came to L.A. You know, it wasn't something we wanted to do. But now as I look at it, you know, over the next several years, I think you could live anywhere. You know, there could be distance visual effects. And I think there'll be companies at first that will be the spokes. So there'll be a company in India and a company in Shanghai and a company in New York and a company in Brazil, etc. And then what will happen is the overhead will start to eat at them too, because the Moore's Law will go in the opposite direction. We want it cheaper and twice as much. No, that's Moore's Law. Cheaper and twice as much and twice as powerful. And as a result, I don't think those companies will be able to hold together either. And it's just going to become a bunch of freelancers.
What about the content, though? We've talked a little bit about that earlier. I mean, where do you see anybody doing? I mean, it's obvious that's what has to happen for the visual effects companies to have more control or more power. What would it take? What was going to take for some of these companies to start doing, getting into that game?
I think what they need to do is, a couple of things. I think the people that run those organizations need to understand that people that create content and business people that help support content are different skill sets than creative people that do matte paintings or do animation. And the business people that surround it are different kinds of people than they need. So I think they're going to have to transition and not say, you know, Janice over here, who used to be my salesperson, has a script and she's really, really interested. So I'm going to make Janice the head of development, you know. That's just not going to work. You need real people that's what it's like saying, you know, Bob's sister was an animator. I'm going to make Bob an animator. So that's one thing. They need to take it more seriously and find people. And they need to grow people in that area, just like you would an animation company. You need to find young animators and allow them to become animation directors. And then they're going to need some capital resource. And my sense is that the capital resource is not going to be available in the United States, but it will be available in other countries, and they need to play that other country card. And then finally, they need to take it seriously. You know, the management of the company needs to realize that the future of their company is all about creating a Pixar-like model. And it doesn't need to be necessarily in animation, you know, because that's a limited market as well, but in all forms of content.
It's funny. I was at Disneyland recently and, you know, rode the Pirates of the Caribbean. And I remember thinking when I first heard they were going to make that movie, oh, my God, what are they going to do? It's
yeah.
such a franchise.
Yeah.
And then, of course, it was such a big success that now the movie's been reincorporated into the ride. And you think about how much impact that's had on the Disney empire.
Huge.
Yeah, and yet, and ILM, I'm sure, did well with it, but still.
Well, ILM probably didn't do very well with it. You know, the ILM got a lot of work and they were nominated for an Academy Award. I don't think they won, did they?
I don't recall.
To be honest with you, when you win an Academy Award at a visual effects company, it actually hurts your business.
Somebody said that at a conference.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember hearing somebody talk about that. I don't remember if it was John Noll or somebody was saying that, you know, it's...
It's detrimental to your business.
Because people are afraid that...
No, it's a financial impact. What happens is you can't charge anymore because you just won the visual effect. You're still in competition with the guy who didn't win the visual effects award. So... If, you know, Rhythm and Use won the visual effects award and it cost them $10, they could say, hell, I'm going to do it for $14. But right down the street, the guy who didn't win it's going to do it for $8. So he's got that airplane problem, right? Then the double impact of that is the guy who won the Visual Effects Academy Award at his company is in your office asking for a raise because he won the Academy Award. So it's sort of a conundrum. Well, let's talk about international stuff.
Okay.
You know, because there's a lot of conversation and discussion about that. And that's inevitable, you know, just inevitable, because there is nothing particularly spectacular about, you know, Western artists. Some, you know, Eastern artists are just as good, and Indian artists are just, and Brazilian artists are just, they just got to find the best artist. So it's not the artist that does the work. That it's not the artist that is the difference between an American effects team and a Brazilian effects team. What it is it's the experience, right? So if you, and I believe firmly that if you can go through two cranks of the wheel, the first crank's going to be really bloody, right? And it was really bloody at Digital Domain on True Lies, I'll tell you, you know. But once you go to the second crank of the wheel, which for us was Apollo 13, it got much better. And after the second crank, we now had a pipeline. We knew what we were doing. It wasn't as elegant as I'm sure it is today, but it was a lot more elegant than zero, right? And what's going to happen in countries overseas is they're going to get a shot at the turn of the crank. And once that happens, all bets are off, because what's going to happen is in India, as we know, a person who in the United States would make $80,000 of what they're doing makes $25,000 of what they're doing in India, and they're happy about it. So the whole economic structure of doing work here in the United States is going to change. And that's significant for the artist. Now, an opportunity for the artist is that if you're at the top of your game as an American digital artist, you'll be at the top of your game. You know, no one's going to say, hey, you know what, I'm really not interested in using Scott Stockdyke. You know, he's brilliant. But there are going to be middle-level artists, and what my advice to them is to start getting their passports in order and start to being part of the team that goes over to Mumbai, Shanghai, Manila, Buenos Aires, etc., and starts to teach them what the pipeline is. And there are going to be great opportunities for those people, plus wonderful opportunities to travel.
But yeah, like you said, it's a young man's game, so that might not be, that's not as big of a problem for the younger.
That's right. I mean, you know, it's going to be tough for 50-year-old guys.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. I was curious how you feel about, I mean, it's obvious that Nuke was created on your watch at Digital Domain. Yeah. It was a very, you know, powerful tool internally, and now it seems like it's very much becoming the de facto standard in the business. That's got to be quite gratifying.
Yeah, you know, for years and years and years when I was at ILM, one of the issues at ILM was, you know, the barrier to entry into our business was our proprietary software. And that you could go and you could buy Softimage, for example, but you couldn't get our plugins and you didn't know what our pipeline was, et cetera. And so as a result, we guarded that very, very stringently. You know, we were very tough about it. And when I started Digital Domain, I felt the same way. You know, I created Digital Domain basically as a result of my years at ILM. And then one day it became Brad Call, who was at the time the chief operating officer of the company, came to me and said, you know, why are we're looking for cash to be able to develop content, which is really what the end game's got to be. We can't really make that much cash on our services business. So what are the things that we could sell? And we had heated debate until Brad showed me the wisdom of his ways and the stupidity of mine. And that it became obvious that is no longer a barrier to entry. And that at some point, monetizing the software was worth so much more than keeping a barrier to entry into an industry that you don't make any money in. Right? So the good news is nobody else can do compositing like us. And the bad news is we don't get paid anymore and we can't make any money doing it. So it was, well, let's see if we could monetize Nuke. the mistake that we made was Nuke was not going to be accepted by other companies if it was a digital domain-owned company.
Which is how it first rolled
out. Which is how it first rolled out. And it was, I guess, later with the Foundry and what happened there. But it's the most powerful compositing software out there. And, you know, I teach at Savannah College of Art and Design, and, you know, these kids are, you know, 19-year-old kids. They're just crazy about it, you know. So it's gratifying, you know. I wonder oftentimes, Phil Beffrey was the guy who was the lead software guy on that team. It was really his brainchild. And I don't even know where he is now, but I'm sure he's looking back at it going, damn, we were good.
Wow. That's interesting. We should try to find him.
Yeah. 10 years ago, when I was sitting behind the desk at Digital Domain, I looked out of the landscape. My thought was that the company that would not make it would be Rhythm and Hues. And the reason I thought it wouldn't make it was several different scenarios. They didn't have much cash. They had difficulty running their business. They ran it like a family. I didn't think, maybe naively so, that they had the business skills to be able to do it, you know, or maybe egotistically so. But now, when you look at the Big Five, I think they're the healthiest of all the companies. And the reason I think they're the healthiest of all the companies is, in many ways, the reasons why I didn't think they'd make it 10 years ago. Because they're not run like a business. They're run like a family. They're run like a small mom-and-pop shop, but it happens to be a big mom-and-pop shop. And they don't have to worry about return on equity, return on investment criteria. And they made another, I thought, an amazing move, which was they opened shop in India. And they did it in a way.
A while ago, too.
Yeah, and they did it in a way not like others have tried, which is go in there and buy a company. They did it in a way where they grew it. You know, so the fellow Prashan, who was one of their top executives here in L.A., is an Indian, went over there and decided to, you know, build a company from scratch. And so they're competitive on a pricing level, and the other Big Five are not.
Well, now they've got two locations in India. They've got a place in Malaysia, and they're looking at China, they said at the last conference I was at.
Yeah.
So, I mean,
clearly it's working.
So I wanted to ask you about Secondhand Lions. That was an effort. That was a dip into producing, right?
It was. And the reason why I chose Secondhand Lions was a couple of reasons. One was, wherever I'd go and start talking about producing content, most everybody would say, well, but what do you guys know about story? Right? So, oh yeah, you might know how to blow up planes and you might know how to sink ships and all of that stuff, but you're technicians. What do you know about actors and story? So Secondhand Lions was a movie that had nothing to do with sinking ships or blowing up stuff. It purely was an actor's medium, you know, and we were lucky enough to cast three great actors. And it was a script written by the director, and a guy who'd written some great scripts before wrote Iron Giant. So I thought it would be a great entry into showing Hollywood that as a producer, that I have an understanding of story and content, and it's not just about blowing shit up. It didn't work that way. And so what happened is people came back to me and said, well, it was a really sweet movie and it's lovely, but it really didn't take advantage of any of your skill sets. You know, why aren't you doing movies that blow shit up? And so it was a good experience, but it wasn't what I had hoped it would launch us to be. And my hope was that as a result of Secondhand Lions, now directors would want to work with us, and that we brought a lot of production value to the film that they couldn't have afforded. But we didn't have the cash reserves to be able to do it. And here's another interesting look into Digital Domain. I think it's fairly well known that there was some issues between the owners of Digital Domain. And you know, the capital structure of the company was such that 100% of the shares were spoken for. So there was a time when I was really close to Terry Rossio and Ted Elliott, who, in my opinion, are the two greatest writers in Hollywood today of that genre, right? Pirates of the Caribbean, Men in Black, Aladdin, you know, Shrek. I mean, these guys did it. And I thought, well, I think maybe I found my John Lasseters. The problem was is that I couldn't get the shareholders of the company to understand that for us to go into the content industry, we have to find guys like them, like those guys, and give them big pieces of the company, because we're not going to pay them, right? They make $2 million a script or whatever. But to really get them invested and to have equity in the company, we need to give them equity in the company. And the capital structure of the company was such that we couldn't do it. And that was really the plan, you know, to be able to transition the company into a company that made films like Terry and Ted had written. A little bit about how visual effects has been treated in the industry, because it really is the whipping boy. And my feeling is, as simple as when we look at credits on a film that is a big visual effects film, visual effects people are after the greenskeepers and the caterers, you know. So the industry has changed. But the industry, the business, has not recognized the change in the industry. You know, to get a visual effects supervisor credit on the front credits or main credits of the movie, you have to petition, right, the DGA to be able to do that. They won't allow it, right? The first, as they call it, technical credit has to be a unit production manager. So if we want to have, let's say we do a movie like Titanic, and Rob Legato, and we got to face it, you know, if Titanic didn't have a ship that was sinking, it just would have been a love story, right? So Rob Legato and Digital Domain on that film were really critically important, much more important than, let's say, the set designer, the production designer, then the costumer, then even the composer.
Well, we've talked a lot about this, the fact that visual effects crosses all those crafts.
That's
you just
right.
mentioned.
That's
and
right.
Oftentimes is on the film longer.
Right.
Is involved with all those areas, and yet we can't get the respect.
We can't get the respect, and not only do we not get the respect, we also don't get the money. Right. So, you know, it's a very, very interesting situation, And I think today, now I have 18 of the top 20 movies of all time are visual effects movies. And I think there are only two or three movies that have movie stars in it. The rest of them don't have movie stars. You know, yes, Harrison Ford is a movie star now, but at the time he did Star Wars, he was a carpenter, right? So the credit, the value, and the financial value has not been due to the visual effects industry.
Well, and some people like Bill Taylor at the VES meeting, at the annual meeting, called for three things. For California to step up and start realizing they want to keep this business here in some way and start doing some incentives. He called for a trade association, and he also called for a visual effects union.
Right.
The union thing becomes very controversial. People get very upset when you use the word union, but the differentiation for...
Well, I would use the word guild.
Guild?
Not
okay.
Union, because union conjures up a whole different issue. But I would use the word guild, you know, and I've tried this before. And you know, my career in visual effects has been mercurial, as you know. And I wound up really turning my back on the Visual Effects Society. And the reason I turned my back on it is because I thought there was an opportunity at the time to really stand up and say, we're mad as hell and we're not going to take it anymore. And everybody was so scared to death to do that, that we had another 10 years of acting like, you know, the sheep in the closet, right? And we still act like that in our industry. And now more than ever, we're the most powerful group there is.
But VES has said that's not their role. They won't. So somebody else has to have that role.
Well,
who is that?
Well, I don't know. You know, I don't really know. But there needs to be something. I mean, I'm personally not, on a personal level, while it's very nice to educate the people about how matte paintings are done and how models and miniatures and all of that, it's very nice, right? But at the end of the day, if companies are closing left and right and men and women are being put out of their jobs, you know what? It's really nice to talk about Albert Whitlock, but, you know, I want to talk about saving Jeff's job, because I know Jeff and I know his family. And that's what I've done for the last, you know, 25, 30 years of my professional career. I've created jobs for people. And so you look out there and you say, these people are just not working anymore. So what are you going to do about it? Oh, let's have a party. Let's not have a party. Let's put a damn guild together and walk into the studios and say, we're mad as hell and we're not going to take it anymore. I mean, Michael Ovitz didn't throw a party when he decided that he was going to get what he wanted to get for his actors and his directors. And I think the time has come. I actually think it's too late. You know, it's starting to crumble, and it's not good.
So tell people what you're doing now.
What am I doing now? I am doing some consulting for Savannah College of Art and Design. They're opening up a studio, a campus in Hong Kong, a digital college in Hong Kong. I have an affinity for Asia, spent a lot of time there, and so I'm helping them do that. I taught a visual effects supervision course. I co-taught it with Stuart Robertson, who's a guy who worked for me for years, won the Academy Award on What Dreams May Come. And so I would go once a week in September, October, November and teach a course. And it was interesting because he would teach the course from the perspective of being a visual effects supervisor, and I would teach the course from being this, from the perspective of managing visual effects supervisors. So I think the kids got a lot out of it. I know I did. I loved it. I'm also doing lecturing. I go around the world and give lectures, and I have several projects that I'm producing and developing. I have one project that's a Bollywood-Hollywood project that we have funding for, and it's called Narsima. And it's the legend of sort of the Hindi legend, very ancient legend of sort of like the wolf man, but it's a lion. And it dates back 3,000 years or something. And then I have about three or four other projects that are in various stages, most of them at script level at this point. And I'm looking for financing for it. And, you know, it's a difficult time to find financing. And they're not necessarily, you know, $150 million films, though a couple of them are. Some of them are $3 million films. So that's the other thing that I'm doing. And then it's just enjoying life and not having to run a big visual effects facility is heartwarming.
You look very good and very happy, so it's great to catch up with
thanks,
you.
Thanks, Jeff.
Thanks.
Appreciate it.
Well, thanks for that, Jeff, and thank you, Scott, for being with us here at FX Guide. Of course, you can check out our other podcasts at fxguide.com. We have now both the normal FX Guide TV and the Spanish version of FX Guide TV, as well as our digital production, digital cinematography podcast, Red Center. That's it for me for this week, and on behalf of Jeff, John, and myself, thank you so much for being with us.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by using the Contact Us links at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright 2008 FX Guide LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.